It's a simple question, really. Can he or can't he? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Monday, today, the 21st day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The first word on the program today goes to Constance Hunter. She's the global head of strategy at AIG, also a board member at the National Association for Business Economics, which, as it happens, had its annual conference today in Washington, D.C., and which, I guess, also as it happens, had a guy named Jay Powell come and give a speech and do a Q&A. Here is the relevant Q and A that caught our ear.
What would prevent you from doing a 50 basis point move in May?
What would prevent us?
Yeah.
Nothing.
My favorite part of that whole thing is the nervous laugh after Powell answers, because the Fed and its moves on interest rates are the whole economic ballgame right now. Remember, by the way, 50 basis points is just a fancy way to say half of one percentage point. But look, inflation's at a 40-year high, right? Consumers are cranky. The supply chain's still a mess, although less so. But also, there's a war on. Sure, the labor market's good, really good. But the needle that the Fed is trying to thread here, getting inflation under control and keeping the labor market strong and not crashing the economy, that needle's a tough one to thread. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
This is what's referred to as bringing the economy in for a soft landing. And it's necessary right now because the economy's flying too high and hot. The problem starts with us, says Tulane economist Gary Hoover.
About two-thirds of the U.S. economy is made up by consumer spending.
When consumers have a lot of money, like we do now from relief checks and pay hikes, we buy more stuff. If producers can't keep up, demand outpaces supply and prices shoot up. So the Fed raises the cost of borrowing, hiking interest rates, hopefully just enough that
we can softly land in that we can tame inflation without having economic recession. If you look back historically, right, the last time this actually worked was around the 94-95 period. So more often than not, the Fed doesn't get this right.
And every time before, there hasn't been a global pandemic and a war in Europe, which make the Fed's job adjusting supply and demand more difficult. For instance, says University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson,
are we going to be able to get the oil that we need, or are global high oil prices going to make it expensive for our businesses to buy?
The U.S. economy does have one big ace in the hole right now, says Daniel Zhao, senior economist at jobsite Glassdoor.
The labor market remains very healthy. Demand for workers is very high. Job openings are near record levels.
Plus, unemployment's low and hardly anyone's getting laid off. Still, he says a soft landing could be tricky.
The Fed does have to walk a tightrope, and in some ways they're walking that tightrope blindfolded because the environment is changing so rapidly.
Even so, the economists I talked to today believe it would take a pretty big reversal and a lot to go wrong to send the U.S. economy into recession soon. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Speaking of reversals on Wall Street today, well, look, there have been better sessions, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. European diplomats met in Brussels today to discuss whether or not to follow the United States and Britain in banning Russian oil. Undecided is the early verdict. More conversations on that to come. We have had a lot of conversations the past month about the Russian economy, what sanctions are doing to it. Much fewer conversations, far fewer conversations, I guess, about the Ukrainian economy and what actual war is doing to it. So we have gotten Natalie Jaresko on the phone. She was the Ukrainian Minister of Finance from 2014 to 2016. Ms. Jaresko, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
Give me a sense, would you, from the people that I'm sure you're talking to on the ground in Ukraine. We're a business show, so we got to stick to our knitting here. Aside from the human tragedy, what, if anything, can you shed light on with the Ukrainian economy?
Sure. The Ukrainian economy is being strangled right now. Ukraine's economy is made up of a large export segment, and all the ports are blocked and or destroyed. Several of the large steel facilities, which are primary export, have been destroyed. And we're heading into planting season. Ukraine is a major agricultural force in the world. Right now, the challenge for Ukraine is how much physical space, geography is capable of being planted, and then how much do farmers choose to plant versus defend their territory? And then, lastly, what supplies do they have in terms of diesel and petrol, which is typically imported from Russia and Belarus? You know, two major export sectors, both in very, very difficult straits.
Is it fair to say that the Ukrainian economy, specifically those sectors, but also things like dairy and even, consumer, almost anything, it's been converted to a wartime economy, right?
It is a wartime economy, but I actually did take a look this morning with some friends through some grocery stores in the Kyiv area and the suburbs of Kyiv. And there's food. There is milk products. There's meat products, butter. The president and the government have been really pressing for the territory that's not completely bombarded to please continue manufacturing. Food processing is key. In cities like Mariupol in the southeast or in Kharkiv in the northeast, of course, there's nothing functioning.
Here's the thing, though. Even in areas of that country where life is normal, and this is in air quotes, right, it can't be that people are going to work and going about their business as usual. I can't conceive of that.
You're absolutely right. As I said, it's a real effort to get people in more peaceful parts of the country to the extent that they're peaceful to work. And so the government's created a new line of credit at very low interest rates for small and medium-sized business to keep going. So there is a real attempt to get people to keep working if they can. But you're absolutely right. I mean, most people are focused on defense.
Part of the work you did when you were finance minister in 2014 to 16 was to set Ukraine up with foreign lines of credit after the Crimean invasion and after the prior presidency. And I guess the question is, how much of that money is left, do you suppose, and how far can it go?
Well, since then, and especially in the last months, Ukraine has attracted a great deal more financial support. The World Bank, the IMF, the EBRD, European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the United States government and others are providing what I'll call macro support, both to cover the budget deficit of the government, because, of course, tax revenues are not coming in, but also the incremental expenditures. You can imagine you have to pay unemployment to a larger number of people because they're not working. And, sustainability of the government is number one right now at time of war. So it's hard to make any estimate of what the deficit is or what the balance of payments gap would be. But I can tell you that the support continues.
There will come a time where reconstruction and rebuilding is the conversation, not national defense and a wartime economy. What does that look like, do you suppose?
I spent my weekend trying to figure that out. The capital stock, the value of the capital stock in Ukraine is $7 trillion. So if you think about even just 10% of it being destroyed, let alone more, and right now it looks like much more, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars for reconstruction. And, the first source of that should be reparations from Russia. They should have to pay for the damage that they've caused. Second, obviously, again, that international financial community will need to be supportive, whether it's, Alphabet Soup, the IMF, the World Bank, and others, bilateral parties, and then the private sector. I'm right now in Puerto Rico, and I was here in the post-Hurricane Maria period, and, Puerto Rico is 1/66th the size of Ukraine, and the cost of the post-Hurricane Maria rebuilding of this island was estimated at about $80 billion. So what does that tell you about the amount of money that's going to be necessary to rebuild Ukraine?
Natalie Dresko was the Minister of Finance in Ukraine from 2014 to 16. She is, as she alluded to, the outgoing Executive Director of Puerto Rico's Federal Oversight and Management Board. Ms. Dresko, thanks for your time. I do appreciate your expertise.
Thank you.
In the almost 1 month since Russia invaded Ukraine, hundreds of multinational companies have said they are getting out of Russia, either suspending operations or leaving altogether. The going has been noticeably slower in the pharmaceutical industry, though. They say they offer life-saving medications to the Russian people, and humanitarian concerns have to take some degree of priority. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that one.
Big pharmaceutical companies do a lot in Russia, from manufacturing to running clinical trials to drug sales. And after the invasion, they're in various stages of reconsidering their commitments to the country. But their exit calculus is more complex than for, say, McDonald's or Coca-Cola. Veet Henish is the director of Wharton's Political Risk Lab.
They're kind of going down the line of their products and saying which ones are essential for human life and which ones are not, and making some choices there.
Henish says companies have pulled some non-life-saving products like Cialis and Botox. Eli Lilly says it's refocusing its operations on helping people with cancer and diabetes. Lilly and Pfizer both say they're donating profits from Russia to humanitarian efforts. And Novartis has suspended marketing there but is continuing to manufacture at a facility in St. Petersburg. Some critics say the pharma industry should be pulling out of Russia entirely. Bioethicist Arthur Kaplan is with the NYU Grossman School of Medicine.
Remember, it's not a war. It's an invasion. It is basically a giant country bullying another one and saying, we're taking you over. And we're going to use civilian terrorism to do it.
The debate within the pharmaceutical industry has gone public, with leaders of some small and mid-sized companies circulating a letter urging economic disengagement with limits. One of the co-authors is Paul Hastings, CEO of Nkarta Therapeutics.
We're in the business of healthcare, right? We're in the business of helping and curing patients. And we have to make sure that if we're providing medicine, it gets to the patient.
He says Putin should be punished, but healthcare consumers in Russia shouldn't suffer as a result. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Every school day in this country, something like 26 million kids get on school buses to get to class. About 500,000 buses in all, says the National School Transportation Association. And the vast majority of those buses have diesel engines. And that is turning out to be a little bit of an issue. Now, the diesel fuel is up 50% from where it was a year ago. AAA says $5.04 a gallon for a national average, which means school districts are spending way more than they thought they would on fuel to keep those buses going, which, by the way, those buses, they need drivers, also in very short supply in today's labor market. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on that story.
Superintendent David Law has been playing a game of connect the dots with school buses for months now. At the Anoka-Hennepin school district he runs in the suburbs of the Twin Cities, there haven't been enough drivers for existing bus routes. So
we have combined routes and doubled up routes. Some kids have been getting home later. Our bus rides maybe used to be the long end would be 45 minutes. Now it's over an hour.
Now, on top of that, the district is feeling the increased price of fuel.
We anticipate it'll be well over $100,000 of increases in fuel costs for diesel.
And that's with the district splitting the cost with its bus contractor. Law has turned to reserve funds to pay the difference. But he says if the high prices continue, the schools might have to let go of some counselors and social workers.
Because we have to find the money someplace.
Most school districts are just tapping into their federal funds, their federal relief funds, to pay that differential.
Marguerite Rosa is director of the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown. She says districts are also opting to save fuel by going down to a four-day school week.
They're trying to cram school into Monday through Thursday to save on one day a week on transportation.
40% of school districts contract their bus services out, which means some small businesses are feeling the pain too. Dan Hillman's company in South New Jersey has 140 yellow buses in its fleet, some of which drive up to 150 miles a day to multiple schools. The company pays for all its own fuel.
You know, it's not fun, but it's an expense that it's an unknown cost that continues to fluctuate just like everything else.
Hillman says he's trying to bring fuel costs down by, you know, using less fuel. He's telling his drivers to idle less. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You're helped if prices go up, but you're hurt if prices go down.
Wait, what? All right. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 201 points, almost 0.6%, 34,552 today. The NASDAQ gave up 55 points, about 0.4%, 13,838. The S&P 500 dropped 1 point, unchanged basically, 44.61. 11.6 billion American simoleons, that's how much Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is paying to buy the insurance company Allegheny. The acquisition follows Buffett telling shareholders that he was having a hard time finding companies worth buying. Berkshire Hathaway picked up 2.3% today at Berkshire A's current price. That's probably like, what, $100,000, $200,000? I don't even know. Bad day for Apple today and its online services. The App Store, music, podcast, TV, all of them went down this afternoon. Shares in Apple still managed to gain 0.8%. Bond prices way down. Yield on the 10-year Tino, get a load of this, 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have talked just today and also a bunch of times the past 3.5 weeks about Russian resources, wheats and grains and oils, crude oil and gas. Now, steel. Russia is the third largest steel exporter in the world, which is why it matters that the European Union has banned imports of Russian steel. Marketplace's Andy Euler's on that one.
Steel has been a hot-button issue in trade policy since, well...
It's really just been an industry that's been very active in the trade policy space forever.
That's Lydia Cox. She studies trade policy and economics at Harvard. She says baked into this ban on Russian steel is an increase in the amount of steel the EU will allow its members to import from other countries.
So in a way, they're trying to kind of just reallocate where they're buying their steel from, but not necessarily reduce the amount of steel they're importing.
But sourcing that steel from elsewhere could be easier said than done. Russia is a big player in the global market for specific kinds of steel that can be further refined. And a lot of that steel goes to the EU. Milan Wu is head of steel research at Wood Mackenzie. She says countries that import from Russia will be competing to make up for that lost steel.
The supply will be tighter, more people were looking for it, and also the logistics has been disrupted. And, you know, putting tighter supply and higher demand, you get higher price.
Now, lately, when we've talked about steel prices rising, it's because a country's imposing tariffs to protect their domestic steelmakers from being undercut by cheaper imports. This is different. Chad Bown is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
With a higher tariff, if you desperately need the product, you can just pay a little bit more for it. You know, it's just a tax. But with a ban, if you suddenly can't get it at all, then you could be stuck.
By disengaging from Russia, the EU is giving up leverage over one aspect of the country's steel industry that concerns European countries, its carbon footprint. Steelmaking accounts for between 7 and 10% of all greenhouse gas emissions worldwide. Some say the quickest way to decarbonize is to stop making steel the way it's traditionally been done, from iron ore, which is the main way the Russians do it. Daniel Cooper teaches mechanical engineering at the University of Michigan.
That's the dirty stuff. Digging stuff out of the ground and making that into steel is the dirty part of the industry.
EU officials had hoped to persuade Russia to clean things up. But Morgan Bazilian, director of the Payne Institute for Public Policy at the Colorado School of Mines, says now that's taking a back seat.
Will we get that kind of attention and prioritization to focus on these hard to decarbonize sectors like steel right now? No, we will not. It has fallen off of the priority list, at least in the short term.
Industrialized countries may not actually need to import Russian steel. One industry analyst says by investing more in recycling, they could supply 80% of their own needs by 2050. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We take you now to the London Metal Exchange, which is, just like it sounds, a place where metals are traded. It's kind of the global industrial metals exchange, which is, for our purposes today, nickel, the metal, not the coin. It has been, one can safely say, hoo boy, a couple of weeks for nickel. Price collapses from a low of $29,000 a ton to $100,000 a ton, spiking up enough to make the LME cry uncle and actually cancel some trades and, for like a week, just stop trading in nickel. Yes, part of this is the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Not all of it, though, as Marketplace's Matt Levin explains.
Keith Wilde trades on the LME, what the cool kids call the London Metal Exchange. He works for Romco Metals, a UK-based metals recycler. And in the days before Nickel Armageddon, he heard rumors of blood in the water.
There'd been lots of chatter about there was a short position, someone was being squeezed.
Someone who was short selling nickel. A short is when an investor bets an asset will go down in price, usually a stock, but in this case, nickel. A short squeeze is when other investors bet against that short. When a squeeze works, prices rise, the shorting investor has to buy more of the asset, and prices rise again. The squeeze worked so well that when nickel reached 100 grand, the LME just shut down trading.
This is an exchange that's been around for 145 years. It's always been the center of metals trading. And all of a sudden, there's no market. There's just no market for nickel.
Part of the reason the LME stopped nickel prices from soaring even higher was that the big loser wasn't just a rich hedge fund. It was someone with a pretty important role in the global nickel industry.
We have strived relentlessly in order to improve the quality of human life.
That's from a delightfully epic promotional video for China-based Qingshan Holding Company. Qingshan improves the quality of human life by making steel and by owning Indonesian nickel mines, which produce about 300,000 tons every year. So a nickel miner wanted the price of nickel to go down. Wait, what?
If you're a nickel producer, you're helped if prices go up, but you're hurt if prices go down. And so what you might want to do is to protect against prices going down, you short sell.
Craig Perong researches commodities markets at the University of Houston. Oil companies short oil to hedge risks. Gold miners do it. Big ag does it. But Perong says Qingshan got out in front of its skis.
Supposedly, they thought that they had come up with this new production technology that was going to drive down prices.
But then Russia invaded Ukraine, and because Russia mines about 7% of the world's nickel, prices went up. Short selling Qingshan was reportedly facing billions in immediate losses before LME stepped in, taking the unprecedented step of canceling trades that had already gone through. That move infuriated some metals traders who lost money they would have made at the expense of Qingshan.
The LME has undermined its reputation as being a neutral referee.
It's important to remember here, nickel is a commodity for a reason. It goes in stainless steel and turbine blades and desalination plants and all types of stuff. And it's hard to ditch fossil fuels without nickel. Roger Len heads marketing at Ascend Elements, which recycles electric vehicle batteries. He says the lithium-ion battery makers he sells to are feeling the pinch.
Volatility in general is not good for the long-term, you know, viability of any market. It's just hard to plan and predict in those cases.
EV makers could opt to go the Tesla route. It responded to rising nickel prices last year by switching some models to a less efficient battery that doesn't use it. But Tesla still had to raise prices this month. The aluminum and cobalt markets are also shooting up. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. Technically, this came out on Friday, but it's worth a shout out today, I think, if only because voluntary back to the office here at Marketplace World Headquarters. starts next Monday, the International Energy Agency has a 10-point plan to reduce global oil use. Number two on that list, work from home, up to 3 days a week where possible. That'd cut oil use globally 500,000 barrels a day. Also, lower speed limits, more mass transit, get rid of business air travel as much as possible. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. A quick follow to Matt's nickel story. I, however, am talking the coin, though. As of today, one nickel worth 6.8 cents if you melt it down. Don't do it, by the way. It's illegal. 3 cents of nickel, 3.8 cents worth of copper. Go figure on that one, huh? Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.